You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. saw increased attention to public health efforts at the beginning of COVID and less attention now. An epidemiologist says that's a common cycle of panic and then neglect that ends up leaving us less prepared for the next disease outbreak. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a unique summer job.
Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night can stop postal carriers from delivering the mail, as the unofficial motto goes. But for some teenage mail carriers in southern Wisconsin, there are even more hurdles to surmount. As WPR's Sarah Lear tells us, the Lake Geneva mail jumpers hop from ship to shore as they deliver letters to lakefront homes.
One of the typical uniforms for U.S. Postal Service mail carriers includes a blue-collared shirt and an over-the-shoulder satchel. But for some mail routes in Lake Geneva, one of Wisconsin's trendy resort cities, a life jacket is part of the necessary apparel. More than a dozen teens lined up on the deck of a cruise ship on a recent rainy morning. They're competing for an unusual summer job, delivering mail by boat on Geneva Lake. During its delivery runs, the mail ship never stops. Jumpers have to leap from deck to pier and back again as they drop off mail and collect outgoing letters. Captain Ray Ames briefs the hopefuls.
Remember, you're going from a moving boat onto a stationary pier. You lead with your right going off. Don't try to plant your feet and stop. Run it out.
18-year-old Erin Hensler grew up near Lake Geneva, where mailboat jumpers are idolized. She hopes to secure a spot for her second summer of jumping.
There's a lot of adrenaline, and, you know, some people chase the runners high. We chase the jumpers high.
Mail's been delivered by boat in the southeast Wisconsin vacation town since the late 1800s, when many newly built estates were hard to reach by road. Now carriers can drive mail trucks to those houses, but some lakefront homeowners still like to keep the tradition alive. Close to 80 of them choose to have their letters and newspapers dropped off by mailboat jumpers every summer. It's part of a long-standing agreement between the cruise line and the local post office. Harold Freestead became part of that legacy when he started driving the mailboat in the 1960s. The 83-year-old has since retired after decades managing the cruise line, but he still returns to the lake to witness tryouts.
Such a positive experience to be able to jump right off on these private piers and this elegance all around you and all the people on the boat that love every second of it.
Try and make sure.
All right, grab with both hands.
The job is coveted and it requires firm footing. Run too fast before you jump back on the boat and you risk a collision. That's how a few past jumpers have cracked the ship's glass windows. Hesitate, and you'll plunge straight into Geneva Lake, like 16-year-old Emma Bond during tryouts.
She in? She went in.
The boat kept chugging along at about 10 miles per hour.
And I tried to pull myself back, but the momentum of the boat, or trying to get to the boat, just pulled me in. My mom packed extra clothes just in case, and I think she jinxed me.
Trying to stay dry is just part of the job. The boat jumpers also give tours to the passengers who ride along during each mail run.
All the next six properties are especially interesting as they are currently, or were at one point, all part of the Rigby estate.
That's 19-year-old Marissa Torres-Raby, one of the more experienced jumpers, talking about the history of the mansions that were built along the lake by Chicago business titans. During tryouts, the boat jumpers are graded on their narration, and former male jumper Katie Tice is one of the judges. She's looking for jumpers with stage presence.
So we're looking at people skills and athleticism and how comfortable they are with all that put together.
Not every part of the job is glamorous. Jumpers start sorting mail by 7 a.m., and they have to clean the ship's bathrooms. But mailboat jumpers say there's no other way they'd rather spend their summers.
WPR's Sarah Lear brought us that story on the Lake Geneva mail jumpers. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. The federal COVID emergency officially ended last month, And as part of the negotiations between House Republicans and President Joe Biden to raise the national debt limit, they agreed to force a return of $27 billion in funding to federal agencies that had been set aside for fighting the pandemic. According to reporting from NPR, this clawback included a significant amount from the Public Health and Social Services Emergency Fund for Emergency Preparedness and Response. Our next guest says we are in a predictable cycle of panic and neglect that leaves us unprepared for the next public health emergency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How prepared do you feel the U.S. is for future public health emergencies? Do you see lessons learned or lessons ignored from COVID? What questions do you have for our guest epidemiologist about how the public health system works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Caitlin Jedalina is the founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist and director of population health analytics at Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. She recently wrote about this in that newsletter. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Now, first of all, this take back of funds at the end of the public health emergency, you describe it, quote, there being chaos rippling throughout public health under the surface. What was the immediate impact of pulling this money back out of public health funding?
Yeah, we didn't really know what the immediate impact was until it started unfolding and the implementation was sent down the federal lines. And I think that this rippling effect is just not apparent to the average person because, of course, we're in a different phase of the pandemic, one that seems much more manageable with COVID-19. Why would we possibly need funding for an emergency? Well, this chaos is an incredible reality to us on the ground, and it's the clearest sign yet that the U.S. is really resorting to its roots in public health of, like you said, cycles of panic and neglect.
And that's the core of your piece. We get really interested in public health and argue about it when there's a public health crisis going on, and then out of sight, out of mind once it ends. Can you talk about how that pattern has come and gone and what it means for our preparedness?
Yeah, you know, this cycle of panic and neglect isn't new. In fact, it even has a name. The Sisyphean cycle was coined after Greek mythology about a trickster who received basically internal punishment for trying to cheat death and was condemned by the gods to roll a boulder up a steep hill for eternity. And every time he reached that top of the hill, the rock rolled back to the bottom, forcing him to start over again. And this hamster wheel effect is all too familiar in public health. COVID-19 wasn't the first boulder we've pushed up a hill. For example, in 2003, with the SARS epidemic, we pushed a SARS vaccine as quickly up a hill as possible. But then SARS was thankfully contained, research money dried up. No vaccine was made and the boulder fell down the hill again. I think what people need to recognize is if that boulder didn't fall down, we would have had a COVID-19 vaccine for the pandemic far quicker, 17 years later, than we did. I think there was a lot of hope among the public health atmosphere that a pandemic would change this model, right? Surely losing 1 million people could change something. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like that. And after giving our all, we're actively watching this boulder roll down the hill again.
When it comes to our public health infrastructure, you know, we've got federal public health agencies and state and lots of local, county, municipal, tribal, et cetera, et cetera. Did we learn any lessons about how to coordinate among all those levels better? Or is that another case of, you know, we started there, got there, and then let the boulder roll back down the hill?
Gosh, we learned a lot. We learned a lot about the need of coordination. You know, local health departments and state health departments do an amazing job on smaller outbreaks before the pandemic, but COVID-19 was just a completely different beast. And it showed our underfunded, fragmented public health infrastructure and really shed light on it. And like you said, the need for coordination. Right now, there's a massive move forward for data modernization so we can have data talk across state lines and to CDC more clearly. But even that coordination isn't being implemented on the ground. And a lot of people are fearful that we haven't or we're not implementing those lessons learned. And so I think that as As professionals, we've certainly learned a lot, but again, implementation, what actually changes, is unfortunately due to congressional funding and us figuring out a way to end this perpetual cycle of panic and neglect.
Now, you mentioned that previous SARS outbreak, and you point toward one country that you think did learn lessons, and that's Vietnam. Can you talk about how they handled that one, what they tried to learn from it that you say helped deal with COVID now?
Yeah, Vietnam's a really interesting story, and I've loved learning about them and watching them throughout the pandemic. You know, they have one of the lowest cumulative COVID deaths in the world. And this isn't because they just had a magic eight ball. You know, one reason is that they learned from their previous mistakes. They had an imperfect response to SARS. And instead of just going back to business as normal after SARS, they changed their entire system, public health system, through adequate funding, through implementation of a national public health response system, through core communications, through emergency capabilities. And it really paid off during the pandemic. And one thing I've been really hopeful for is us learning what worked and what didn't work and why during COVID, because this was really one of the first pandemic emergencies the United States has really had to face. And it would be a tragedy if we did not learn from those lessons.
We're talking to Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist. We're talking about the way the United States responds to, then moves on from, public health emergencies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You have questions for our guest. Do you think we've learned any lessons, or are we as unprepared as we might have been before COVID? Join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in public health out there, love to hear your perspective on this. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about cycles of panic and neglect in public health. Our guest is Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What lessons, if any, do you hope we learned from our public health response to COVID-19? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Joe is with us in Star Lake. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. This is, might seem a very small thing, but I think it's a lot bigger than people realize. And when your guest was talking about core communication in a pandemic situation, this could be very important. We're a very visual society anymore. Most people are getting their information from television. And all through the pandemic, every time any news show covered the pandemic, even if it was a very positive thing about getting vaccinated, all they showed was images of people getting shots. My wife and I would just watch this over and over and over and think of Marshall McLuhan. It was totally the wrong message. It just made people anxious. And you never watch a drug company will never do that. You know, they'll talk about their drug, but they won't see somebody getting shot with it. It was just the worst possible thing we could have done. And so we saw such an anti-vaccine attitude grow up. And I think this really played a role in it. And I think we should address that well in advance of the next time.
Interesting.
In fact.
Joe, yeah. Thanks for the call. Caitlin, the way we communicated messages to the public, we being the public health community, we in the media, the government, are there lessons you hope we learned as Joe hopes we do?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I completely agree with Joe, and I could sit here for hours talking about it. But quickly, I completely agree. We completely botched the scientific communication and knowledge translation throughout the pandemic, both reactive, right? So combating mis and disinformation, but I think even more so proactive communication. We're not good at risk communication. We're not good at talking about uncertainty and taking people along for the scientific discovery ride. We didn't have massive health campaigns around vaccines. And so people, rightfully so, had a ton of questions and nowhere to find evidence-based information to make decisions off of. And this is a huge problem, and we need to fix it so we get trusted, relevant, understood, and then used information out in a timely manner when people need to make decisions. And this is something I fear that we also haven't learned throughout the pandemic. And I've been disappointed in the little movement towards that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Joe, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Caitlin Jedalina. You can follow her work and read the piece we're talking about on the newsletter online called Your Local Epidemiologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Nancy is with us in Minocqua. Nancy, hi.
Yes, I'm kind of just upset and tired of our healthcare in this country and the pandemic and all that being a bipartisan. It's like each side has to do something to take something away from the other side. Democrats have to get it, then Republicans want to take it away, and it should just be something that we work together for to have healthcare in this country.
Nancy, thanks for that call. That's interesting, Caitlin, because when we look back at past pandemics, it seems kind of predictable that there's going to be some kind of political divide. And we read stuff about the 1917 flu outbreak and arguments over mask requirements, the first smallpox inoculations, not even vaccines yet in the 1700s, George Washington requiring troops to get inoculated. Is this something that epidemiologists like look at and try to figure out how to contend with, given that it seems to happen in most outbreaks?
It does happen in most outbreaks. In fact, public health is inherently political. We get our funding from Congress. We have to, outbreak and emergency decisions aren't just based on science, but it's also based on cultural and moral and psychological views of communities. And it requires bi-directional relationship with communities. And so I'm just as exhausted as Nancy about the bipartisanship and this fight against each other. I think one thing we could have done and should have done much better, and in fact, Vietnam did this, was we needed to set the stage of SARS-CoV-2 much earlier and really frame it as it's us against a common enemy, the virus, rather than us against each other.
Thanks a lot.
That messaging framing would have helped a little, but it's going to get political, and epidemiologists are not trained in that. And I think that we need to be, and particularly I'm very excited for the new director at the CDC, Mandy Cohen, because she gets politics and she gets operations. And I think it'll be very interesting to see what she can do with that.
Thanks for that call, Nancy. Daryl is with us now in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Yeah, I think that the health organization did everything they possibly could to make the public aware of what they thought would help with COVID. And we didn't have any experience with this in the past. This is all new to everybody. And also we had a president in office who did everything he could to fight against all the good advice that was put out there to get vaccinated, to get COVID shots and everything, and he laughed at it and made it, oh, it's not a big deal, it's just going to go away on its own. So we didn't even have a president that could lead and show the public the right direction to go to, and that really played a huge part against not being successful with having COVID handled properly.
Gotcha. Daryl, thanks a lot for that call. Caitlin, why don't we focus in on Daryl's first point there that, this is a disease that we hadn't encountered exactly before. It was something different. And that's in some ways always going to be the case in a pandemic. How we react to one disease might look different from another. Can you talk about that scramble to get a grip on a disease that may not look like the last pandemic?
It is a scramble. And I think that's a great way to explain it. And I think the best way to bring the public along is to communicate consistently about what we do know, but more importantly, what we don't know and how we're trying to find those answers. Because the information is going to change, and it was changing incredibly rapidly. And we weren't bringing people along for that scientific discovery ride, which made it really challenging for people to pivot when we found out new information and new ways to protect ourselves. And that's something we can do better in other in other crises, right? It's crisis communication 101. Be first, be right, be credible, and be empathetic. And I would argue that we failed on a lot of those fronts.
I want to take a minute or two to talk about where we are with COVID right now, Caitlin. The public health emergency is over, but it's not gone. COVID, as I'm reading, the seventh leading cause of death in the United States in this current year, 2023, over 1,000 deaths a week for the most part. What are you watching for in the current state of COVID, even though it's not, you know, as front and center as it was?
Yeah, we're in a really interesting time right now. In fact, in epidemiology, we don't even have a word for this like transition state between full-blown emergency and predictability. We're really in this transition phase. I think that, you know, all of us are really looking to see how the rest of the year plays out. Like you said, COVID is still around. It's mutating about twice as fast as flu. And I think the big question we have right now is, when is it going to become into more a predictable pattern? Is this the year that it falls into winter respiratory season with RSV and flu, or are we going to see multiple waves still? And no one really knows that answer. And unfortunately, we are at the mercy of time. We're also all holding our breath that we don't see a variant of concern come out of the blue. We actually have a pretty high probability of that happening, about 40% in the next year. And what that means and how hard it will be to have resources and inform people, given that we're not in an emergency mode with tons of federal funding, will be very interesting, to say the least, of how that unfolds. So there's still a lot of unanswered questions. I think a lot of us are enjoying this lull in massive transmission and really getting prepared for the fall and winter.
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist. We talked to her about the ups and downs in attention to public health. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out federal broadband expansion money coming to parts of Wisconsin that don't have access to high-speed internet connections. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an argument based on the independent legislature theory that would let state legislatures around the country set election laws without input from state courts, governors, or state constitutions. We'll find out how their decision could affect future elections in Wisconsin and beyond. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the rate of people who say they've been diagnosed with depression in the U.S. is reaching new highs. We'll talk to a Wisconsin clinical psychologist about what might be driving that trend and what we can do about it. First, on Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against an unusual legal theory that would give state legislatures complete power to control how federal elections are conducted in their state. According to what's known as the independent legislature theory, state lawmakers could set election laws without having to answer to any checks and balances from other governing bodies in their state, the courts, governor, even the state constitution. The ruling comes from a case in North Carolina. It's called Moore versus Harper, but it could mean a lot for the future of federal elections here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you watching for this result from the U.S. Supreme Court? What do you make of this idea, this independent state legislature theory? What questions do you have about the ruling, what it means here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, nice to be here.
Like a lot of legal cases that make their way to the U.S. Supreme Court, Howard, it's kind of a tangled road. Can you give us the highlights and what was ultimately at stake before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Sure, I can. But I actually think we have to go back all the way to Bush versus Gore, believe it or not, to explain what's going on in this case. So one of the less remarked upon elements in Bush versus Gore, remember that was, of course, a case under very peculiar circumstances, but one of the big arguments was whether the Florida legislature could be bound by the Florida Supreme Court to act in certain ways that the litigants, you know, wanted them to or didn't want them to do. that introduced this idea, or rather in the context of that argument, there was introduced this idea of the independent state legislature doctrine. And the idea is that, as you mentioned in the opening, the Constitution specifies that state legislatures shall determine the manner in which federal elections are held. The claim was that preempts the relationship between the state legislature and, say, the state court, and therefore it preempts the relationship between the state legislature and the state constitution. In North Carolina, the Democratic-dominated Supreme Court struck down a partisan gerrymander on the grounds that it violated the North Carolina Constitution. That was called Harper 1. That was appealed up to the Supreme Court. While that appeal was pending, there was an election, and the North Carolina Supreme Court was taken over by a conservative pro-Republican majority, which promptly overruled the previous Supreme Court's ruling. So the first question was this case moot? Mm-hmm. The U.S. Supreme Court said the case was not moot because even though the North Carolina Supreme Court had determined, I realize this gets complicated, but had determined that under the North Carolina Constitution, there's no rule against partisan gerrymandering, is still the case that new districts had to be drawn and there had to be some standard for what those would be. It's at this point that the theory comes in. One side claimed that North Carolina's legislature can draw any districts they want, untrammeled by any requirements of the state constitution, however they're interpreted. That's the independent state legislature theory. The reason it's so important is that just a couple of years ago, in a case called Lucho versus Common Cause, the Supreme Court ruled that the U.S. Constitution puts no limit on partisan gerrymandering. So in other words, if the theory had been accepted, there would be no possible limitation on gerrymandering, and by extension, no limitation on anything a state legislature did with respect to an election. An extreme case of the theory, following its logical conclusion, you might argue that a state could say, we don't care how the votes came out, we're going to pick the winner of our state in a presidential election based on our preferences and leave it at that. That theory, the Supreme Court rejected. So where we are now is that in North Carolina, it's still the case that the North Carolina Constitution says nothing about partisan gerrymandering, because that was the most recent ruling by their state Supreme Court. But in other states, it may be the case that state Supreme Courts interpreting state constitutions can still put a limitation on that practice.
Looking at the inspiration, part of the inspiration for this independent legislature idea, the elections clause in the Constitution just has the word legislature, and proponents, as I understand it, Howard, say, well, they just say legislature, that means legislature, full stop. It's all them. Other people point out, no, you have to assume the legislature in the context of being a legislature guided by its state constitution with the usual checks and balances. Is that at the heart of some of the debates we see over this?
That's exactly right. And it gets even more abstract and more philosophical and perhaps more absurd than that. Go back to Bush versus Gore again. Well, one doesn't have to. One argument is, and this is the argument, this is the approach that usually applies in essentially all other situations. And that is to say, a state legislature, or the U.S. Congress for that matter, only exists as the creation of its constitution. There would be no U.S. Congress without the U.S. Constitution. There would be no state legislature without the state constitution. Therefore, the word legislature means this thing created under the state constitution by this state, you know, people governing themselves. That's really the more traditional argument. The argument that came out of Bush versus Gore, which is radical, is no, we can do a kind of textualist linguistic game and say that where the word legislature appears in this context, and by the way, this argument is not made where the same word appears in other contexts, but where the legislature appears in this context, it means what I like to call the legislature 2.0, a virtual version unrelated to its usual self, with powers, responsibilities, a position in the system of checks and balances completely different from everything that normally applies. And the argument is that alternative version of the legislature is the one we should be talking about, and it is unlimited by anyone.
Talking to Howard Schwaber. Howard.
I was just going to say, you know, that was a bridge too far even for this court, although it's worth noting there were 3 votes on the current court in favor of that theory. So, you know, no matter how much someone like me might say this is a crazy idea, there's no guarantee it won't come back.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison, affiliate faculty of the law school, emeritus professor of political science, looking at this Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decision yesterday on this idea of the independent state legislature, how much power a state legislature has to regulate federal elections within the borders of that state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision? Rejecting that idea, mostly anyway. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest, or email ideas at WPR.org. Howard, some people are saying, wait a minute, part of this ruling leaves the door open for some challenges in federal courts on elections. And at least as reported by NPR, some Republican strategists say the first test case may well come from gerrymandering, partisan boundary lines drawn in Wisconsin, because we're expecting these, our current state map, to go up before the Supreme Court after management of that court changes in August. What are you looking for there?
Again, that's absolutely right. So part of the opinion rejected the independent state legislature theory, but then there was an odd comment in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, which said federal courts retain a role to step in and prevent state courts from going too far in interfering with the state legislature's conduct of elections. The problem is he did not provide a single word of explanation for what too far means. So at the moment, it's kind of a wild card. There's an open mandate for federal courts to decide in a given case that a given state legislature has gone too far in interfering with what the state legislature wants to do. The reason that's so disturbing, and Wisconsin really is exhibit A for this, has to do with then a separate question. Just this month, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down an Alabama districting program on the grounds that it was racially discriminatory. In February of 2022, the Supreme Court had been offered a chance to do exactly the same thing, but declined to hear the case. And the reason was something called the Purcell Principle. They said, we can't rule on electoral practices too close in time to an election. That might create confusion. The problem was, in that instance, there was 9 months until the next election. So in that case, in Alabama, the Supreme Court said, well, 9 months is too close to an election to make a ruling. And then after the electoral cycle was long over, came and said, oh, by the way, that system of districting was in fact unconstitutional. That's the kind of thing I would worry about federal courts stepping in and doing. So you can imagine a situation where the Wisconsin state legislature, whether as a matter of partisan gerrymandering, which is of course an issue that's going to come up before the court very, very soon, or something else. Think of all the conflicts there were during 2020 during the election about electoral procedures. The Wisconsin Supreme Court issues some ruling. A federal court says, no, no, we're applying the Purcell Principle, and therefore you can't change what the state legislature wanted to do, even though it may turn out to have been unconstitutional under the state constitution. The other piece of this is that while most of the time, I have to say, I resist the idea that you can reduce descriptions of judicial decision-making to partisanship, favoring one party or the other. I usually think it's much more about ideology and beliefs about constitutional principle. In this one area, that is the question of how willing federal courts will be and the U.S. Supreme Court will be to intervene in procedural electoral disputes, here there's been a really, really clear and consistent partisan bias. So the very same U.S. Supreme Court that said 9 months until the election is too short a period of time for a court to step in and change electoral rule, as some people remember, in 2020 was perfectly willing to change a rule about how ballots would be collected 2 days before the election. In other words, this Purcell rule, as it's called, seems to be standardless, infinitely flexible, and used in a highly partisan manner, and that fits right in to the blank check mandate that the Supreme Court has just given federal courts to step in and stop state courts from applying the state constitution whenever doing that goes, quote, too far, whatever exactly that means.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, a political science professor emeritus at UW-Madison, affiliate faculty at the law school, breaking down this new U.S. Supreme Court decision that'll affect future elections in the United States, rejecting this concept of the independent state legislature theory. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have your eye on gerrymandering our district lines here in Wisconsin? Are you hoping for a legal challenge to go to the courts? What do you think of this U.S. Supreme Court ruling? saying limiting the powers of state legislatures to run elections, to do things like draw the boundary lines without reference to their state constitutions, their state courts. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus, affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison, talking about a recent Supreme Court decision that rejected the independent state legislature theory, which claimed that state lawmakers could run federal elections in their state without oversight from, say, a state Supreme Court, their state constitution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this ruling? What went into it? What was at stake? What it meant for Wisconsin? Do you have a reaction? Do you have thoughts on what is coming out of this? Were you watching this and worried about the outcome? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that many of us are pleasantly surprised with this ruling after watching the Constitution being reduced to a dead letter, it seems, in the recent past.
Jim, thanks for the call. Howard, a lot of people had their eyes on this one and were worried about what would happen if the court ruled the other way in favor of this state independent state legislature theory. What would have been potentially some of the consequences?
Well, for one thing, all independent districting commissions would become immediately invalidated, right? So a number of states trying to get away from the partisanship that affects the way elections are run have independent commissions that nominate judges or draw voting district lines or come up with election rules. Had the theory been accepted, all of those would be deemed unconstitutional because they're not the legislature. There could even be an argument that legislatures are constitutionally prohibited from giving that authority to any kind of independent agency. So all attempts, essentially, at making elections less partisan and more fair would have been out the window. Second, there would have been just, I think what really motivated some of the justices in rejecting this theory is just that it would have been such uncharted territory. It's a completely unprecedented way to read the Constitution, completely unmoored from, no pun intended, from any other, the way we read the Constitution in any other context. And no one can guess what all of its consequences would have been. There's an interesting irony here, which is just a few years ago, in a case called Arizona Redistricting Commission, John Roberts wrote a dissenting opinion in which he said only the legislature can draw districts. Independent district drawing commissions are unconstitutional. At some point between then and now, he apparently changed his mind. And I think, if I had to guess, the two things that changed his mind, one, are just the radically unknown possibilities of where this might lead, and two, the perception of Jim and people like Jim, that this court, you know, was simply reducing constitutional protections to nothing. And I think that the recent very great criticism of the court and the recent scandals involving what appear to be financial improprieties with justices drives people like Roberts to want to step back a little and maybe step back from the brink.
Thanks for that call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. Howard, I want to go to potentially the most extreme interpretation here, the idea that, and you alluded to this earlier, in 2020, after the elections, after the votes were counted and the initial audits, calls in some states to say, hey, we don't like this outcome. We think it was fishy. Lawmakers have the authority to go in post-vote and change who the electors go to in the election. Here in Wisconsin, there were a couple of Republican lawmakers, I'm talking low single digits here, who made that argument. That was rejected by their caucuses and their party. They didn't advance that idea. What do you make of that? Does this really put that idea to bed now, or is there still some morsel of a thought that that could happen?
Well, you have to view that particular idea that you're describing. And by the way, I don't think it's quite as few Wisconsin Republicans as you're suggesting, but that's a different discussion. In the context of a larger set of ideas. So one reason I always go back to Bush versus Gore is that while that case was based on very specific circumstances, the big message it sent out was, if you don't like the way an election came out, go to court. And think of 2020. the absolute test for a Trump Republican or a Trump loyal Republican these days is, do they accept the conspiracy theory that the 2020 election was stolen? And the Trump supporters tried to pursue that theory in courts and failed, tried to pursue it in Congress and failed, tried to pursue it in state legislatures and failed, have now started going after local election officials, including, for example, the chair of the Wisconsin Election Commission, who is going to be removed because she's been in conflict with election deniers in the Republican Party. This was this the most extreme version, as you say, was the theory that took this strange theory of independent state legislatures and say, hey, we don't have to be bound by elections at all. I think that theory has been put to bed in the sense that I can't imagine a future court more extremely in that ideological space than the one we currently have now. But as I say, there were three votes in favor of it, so one should be cautious. What has certainly not been put to bed at all are attempts to find things outside the electoral process, whether it's lawsuits, weird constitutional theories, attempts to manipulate the personnel of local electoral elections administrative offices. That's going to continue. And I only see that getting worse. In a sense, the door has been opened and there have been no negative consequences to pursuing even the most outlandish theories. So I don't see, to be very specific, Trump supporting Republicans in 2024 being at all hesitant to pursue theories like this in state courts and lower federal courts and outside the court system altogether.
Here in Wisconsin, Howard, you mentioned that redistricting, which will likely hit our state Supreme Court soon, that may be a first test case post this Moore versus Harper decision. Could we see things like if the Supreme Court ruled on the state constitutionality of, I don't know, a voter ID law, a ballot box law, whatever, that might see similar challenges then in federal courts saying, let's see if this is the state court overstepping its bounds under this sort of vague outline that Justice Roberts laid out there?
Absolutely. And let's just take the example of districting for the moment. So I quite confidently expect that, you know, within a few months after August 1st, this Wisconsin Supreme Court will accept a challenge under the state constitution to the very, very gerrymandered districts in Wisconsin. Let's suppose, which I think is probable, that the court will strike them down. At that point, the ball goes in the court, so to speak, of the legislature, which is, of course, dominated by the same Republicans who created these districts. They will try and draw as gerrymandered a set of districts as they think they can get away with under whatever standard the state Supreme Court has announced. Governor Evers, a Democrat, will likely veto it. There will then be a fight between Evers and the legislature, probably with detours into the court to determine the separation of powers between those two branches, until eventually something exists that can then go back to the state Supreme Court and be evaluated under whatever standard they've set. You can see where this is going. All of this is an invitation to endless politicking and litigation. And anywhere along any of those steps, someone from the legislature can go to a federal court and say, hey, under this Moore versus Harper standard, you know, we want you to say, or we want the Seventh Circuit, let's say, to say that the Wisconsin state Supreme Court has gone too far to interfere with the will of the legislature. And of course, the nature of a thing like gerrymandering or voter requirements is that they determine the makeup of the legislature. Every analysis that's ever been done over the last 20 years or so finds that without gerrymandering, there's no possibility that Republicans would have the kind of majorities that they have in the Wisconsin legislature. But this process that I'm describing is literally designed to prevent that situation from being effectively addressed for as long as possible. And by leaving the federal courts as players in this process, Roberts, in his majority opinion, has left open the door to that kind of strategy.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. He joined us to break down this new Moore versus Harper U.S. Supreme Court decision, find out how it could affect future elections nationwide and here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin neuroscientist and clinical psychologist joins us to talk about the causes of and treatments for depression, as growing rates in national surveys of people report being diagnosed with the mental health condition. I'm Rob Ferret. You can find more conversations like these all the time, anytime, stream live at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You can also follow and share our archives there as well. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.